Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The U.S. airline industry continues to face major financial losses after a sharp drop in air travel caused by the coronavirus crisis. The airlines are attempting to persuade Americans that it is safe to fly, even as COVID-19 infections have been rising in some areas. The companies say measures, such as requiring face masks and operating hospital-quality air cleaners, make sitting in an airplane safer than many other indoor settings. Public opinion studies, however, have suggested that many people still do not feel good about getting on a plane. In a June study by Consumer Reports of 1,000 people, 70% said they believed flying was either very or somewhat unsafe. Those questioned said they thought going to a hospital emergency room or standing in line to vote was safer than getting on a plane. In another study requested by an airline trade group, the biggest concern of travelers was the possibility of sitting next to an infected person. John Kontak is a schoolteacher from Phoenix, Arizona. He told the Associated Press he had this fear as soon as he stepped onto a crowded American Airlines flight this summer to Ohio. "I don't know anything about this person who is sitting a foot away from me," Kontak said. They took the bottom line or the dollar over the safety of passengers. "Next time, I'd rather drive back to Ohio than fly. It's safer because I can control it." The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says sitting within 2 meters of other passengers, often for hours, may increase the risk of getting COVID-19. But the CDC also notes that most viruses and other germs do not spread easily on flights because of how air circulates on planes. Public fears about airline infections have resulted in major financial difficulties for the airlines. Several leading carriers have already sought bankruptcy protection, and others could follow if the current economic climate continues. The four largest U.S. airlines lost a combined $10 billion from April through June. While company leaders say they think they will survive, they have lowered their expectations for a quick recovery. "We were all hoping that by the fall, the virus might run its course," said Southwest Airlines CEO Gary Kelly. Obviously, that has proven to be dead wrong. Internationally, air travel is down more than 85% from a year ago, industry data shows. The International Air Transport Association has predicted air carriers will lose $84 billion this year, making it the worst year in the industry's history. The group says traffic will likely not fully recover until 2024. Asia, where coronavirus outbreaks were brought under control earlier, is doing better than the U.S. and Europe. Air travel within China has recovered to about two-thirds its level from a year ago. In the U.S., air traffic is less than one-third of 2019 levels. Air traffic at Europe's more than 500 airports has dropped sharply, down 94% in June compared with the same month last year. There were about 4 million passengers compared with 217 million a year earlier. Travel began rising when many European countries reopened borders in early July. But virus cases are now rising in several nations, leading to the restart of restrictions. I'm Brian Lin.
Clint Perry looked through every part of his kitchen during the stay-at-home period in Detroit, Michigan. He was looking for different foods and leftovers to put together meals. The 33-year-old man is one of many people around the world who has cut food spending and waste during the COVID-19 pandemic. Experts say if these new behaviors continue, they will help fight another worldwide crisis, climate change. Perry works as a model builder for a company in Michigan. He told the Reuters news agency that he and his wife have been finding use for all of their leftovers. In the past, they would forget to bring that food into work and instead buy fast food for lunch. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that one-third of the world's food is wasted every year. That waste is responsible for about 8% of the world's greenhouse gases. Forests are cleared, fuel is burned, and packaging is produced. All of these processes put out greenhouse gases. When people throw food away, it sits on open areas of land and rots, putting more of these gases into the atmosphere. Twan Timmermans supervises the Sustainable Food Program at Wageningen University and Research in the Netherlands. He told Reuters, "The next crisis will be the climate crisis, and the best thing you can do is reduce food waste." At-home food waste in Britain, for example, fell sharply in the early part of the pandemic in April. At the time, just 14% of four main foods was wasted: bread, chicken, milk, and potatoes. That information comes from research by environmental group RAP, which talked to thousands of people. Before the lockdown in Britain, an average of 24% of those foods had been wasted. The waste average there rose to 18% by June, RAP found, but that is still below levels before lockdown. Richard Swanell is director of RAP Global, which works with governments to reduce food waste. He said, although people are reporting wasting more food as restrictions lift, 70% of people want to keep their new low-waste behaviors long-term. Food security has been a big concern during the pandemic. the public bought too many of some basic goods. Farm workers struggled to get to the fields. Meatpacking factories closed because of virus fears. And farm goods that were produced for closed restaurants rotted. But the lower at-home food waste has been one bright thing. Out of need, people have become more organized in planning meals. They have also gained new cooking skills. And they check their cabinets and refrigerators more before they shop. I'm Alice Bryant.
When you learn a new language, you must learn the meaning of individual words. But there is another area that you should pay attention to: expressions, or groups of words. Some expressions are especially useful, whether you want to improve your speaking, listening, reading, or writing skills. These expressions are common in everyday speech, newspaper writing, and academic writing. What are these expressions? In this week's Everyday Grammar, we will explore phrasal expressions.
In recent Everyday Grammar stories, we explored phrasal verbs. Phrasal verbs are groups of words that have a verb and one or more short words. Together, these words have an idiomatic meaning, a meaning that differs from what the individual words suggest. For example, the phrasal verb hang out means to relax or enjoy some time without any planned activity. You can hang out alone or with others. There are also phrasal expressions, groups of words that work together to take on a meaning that is different from what the individual words suggest. Consider this example, the words "there is." This is a phrasal expression. This group of words appears together as a unit, but if you try to think about each word, the meaning might be difficult to understand. Consider this.
There is a bug in my tea.
The word "there" takes the subject position in the sentence, but it does not really give any meaning. It is what grammar experts call an expletive. Together, the words "there" and "is" make a kind of expression, "there is." Without "there is," the sentence would be,
"A bug is in my tea."
Do not fear. You do not need to remember the grammar that we just talked about. What is important is that you understand that English has groups of words that act together. These groups of words are generally formulaic, meaning set, fixed, and commonly used.
Ellie Hinkle is a language expert. She writes that formulaic expressions have to be used and learned as whole units. Hinkle gives many examples, such as, "You are welcome," "Who knows?" "How are you?" and "By the way." Let's consider "by the way." If you think about the words individually, you might have a difficult time understanding this phrasal expression. When someone says "by the way," they mean they are about to propose a new and perhaps less important idea to a conversation. So you might hear an American say the following at the end of a business meeting.
"Thanks, John. By the way, could you send me those budget estimates when you get a chance?"
Norbert Schmidt and Ron Martinez published a report in the Journal of Applied Linguistics about some of the most common phrasal expressions in the British National Corpus a 100-million-word collection of written and spoken language. They suggest that some of the more common phrasal expressions include there is, there are, such as, of course, a few, at least, I mean, you know, a bit, sort of, and in order to. If you listen to everyday speech, you will hear these words often. Many of them are common in writing, too.
Today, we explored phrasal expressions, groups of words that mean something different from what you might expect. The good news is this. These expressions are common, useful, and not too difficult to learn. But they do require careful study and practice in using them.
Ashley, by the way, Schmidt and Martinez also published a list of common phrasal expressions, along with examples. It might help our listeners and readers learn common phrasal expressions.
That's right, I almost forgot. You can find it, along with other useful information, at Schmidt's vocabulary resource page. And that's Everyday Grammar. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm John Russell.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
On July 4th, 1776, the Second Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia, approved the Declaration of Independence. The new country, the United States of America, was at war with its former colonial ruler, Britain. Yet, not everyone in the former colonies agreed with the decision to declare independence. No one knows for sure how many Americans remained loyal to Great Britain. John Adams, the Massachusetts political leader, thought that about a third of the colonists supported independence, a third supported Britain, and a third supported neither side. Today, many historians think that only about 20% of the colonists supported Britain. Some colonists supported whichever side seemed to be winning. As many as 30,000 Americans fought for the British during the war. Others helped Britain by reporting the movements of American troops. Who supported Britain? These groups included people who were appointed to their jobs by the king. They also included leaders of the Anglican Church and people with business connections to the British. Professor Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says many colonists from minority groups remained loyal to the king.
One of the problems of the American Revolution that emerged very quickly was the tyranny of the majority, which the founders, the revolutionary leaders, had not anticipated. But I think we're seeing the problems that emerge when you overthrow an authoritarian leader and you're going to have a relatively democratic society, then protecting the minority becomes a problem.
Other people remained loyal because they did not want change or because they believed that independence would not improve their lives. Some thought the actions of the British government were not bad enough to bring about a rebellion. Others did not believe that the rebels could win a war against a nation as powerful as Britain. American Indians disagreed among themselves about the revolution. Congress knew it had to make peace with the Indians as soon as the war started. If not, American troops might have to fight them and the British at the same time. To prevent trouble, American officials tried to stop settlers from moving into Indian lands. In some places, the Indians joined the Americans, but generally they supported the British. They expected the British to win. They saw the war as a chance to force the Americans to leave their lands. At times, the Indians fought on the side of the British, but left when the British seemed to be losing the battle. The Americans did not forget that the Indians chose to fight for the British. When the war was over, the Americans felt they owed the Indians nothing. African slaves in the colonies were also divided about which side to join during the American Revolution. Thousands of slaves fought for the British. The British offered them freedom if they served in the army or navy. Some American states also offered to free slaves who served, and hundreds of free blacks fought on the American side. Many slaves, however, felt their chances for freedom were better with the British. At least 5,000 blacks served with the colonial American forces. Most had no choice. They were slaves, and their owners took them to war or sent them instead of the owner's sons. Other slaves felt that a nation built on freedom might share some of that freedom with them. In the South, many slave owners kept their slaves at home rather than send them to fight. Later in the war, when every man was needed, many slaves drove wagons and carried supplies. Those who served in the colonial army and navy were not separated from whites. They fought side by side with whites during the American Revolution. But historians say most slaves spent the war as they always had, working on their owners' farms. The American rebels called themselves patriots. Those who supported the British were known as Tories. Patriots often seized the property of Tories to help pay for the war. They also kidnapped the slaves of Tories to use as laborers for the army. Many Tories were forced from towns in which they had lived all their lives. Some were tortured or hanged. In New Jersey, Tories and Patriots fought one another with guns and sometimes burned each other's houses and farms. Some historians say the American Revolution was really the nation's first civil war. The Revolution divided many families. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society tells of a woman named Phoebe. Phoebe was married to a patriot, but her brother was a Tory.
And we think about what it must have been like for Phoebe in the middle between her husband and her brother. So that's a perfect example of a family that was split.
The Patriots were also split among themselves in their thinking. The colonies did not really think of themselves as one nation. They saw themselves as independent states trying to work together toward a common goal. Historian Gordon Wood says, at first, the United States was more like the European Union is today.
When Jefferson said, "My country," he meant Virginia. John Adams said, "My country," meant Massachusetts.
This meant that Congress could not order the states to do anything they did not want to do.
Congress could not demand that the states provide money for the war. It could only ask for their help. George Washington, the top general, could not draft men into the army. He could only wait for the states to send them. Washington showed that he was a good politician by the way he kept Congress and the 13 states supporting him throughout the war. Just as Americans did not all agree about the war, the British people did not agree about it either. Many supported the government's decision to fight. They believed that the war was necessary to rescue loyalists from the Patriots. Others did not think Britain should fight the Americans because the Americans had not invaded or threatened their country. They believed that Britain should leave the colonies alone to do as they wished. King George was not able to do this, however. He supported the war as a way to continue his power in the world and to rescue British honor in the eyes of other national leaders. Whichever side British citizens were on, there was no question that the war was causing severe problems in Britain. British businessmen could no longer trade with the American colonies. Prices increased. Taxes did too. And young men were forced to serve in the Royal Navy. At the start of the war, the British believed that the rebellion was led by a few extremists in New England. They thought the other colonies would surrender if that area could be surrounded and controlled. So they planned to separate New England from the other colonies by taking control of the Hudson River Valley. The British changed their plans after they were defeated in the Battle of Saratoga in New York State. Historian Gordon Wood says the British loss changed the nature of the war.
The French feel at this point that the Americans might make it, and therefore they throw in their support. Once the French come on board, then the British are really panicked. At that point, they offer the Americans everything the Americans had wanted, save independence. But it was too late.
The British experienced many problems fighting the war. Their troops were far from home across a wide ocean. It was difficult to bring in more troops and supplies. Gordon Wood says the distance across the Atlantic was one reason the British lost the war.
Even though they were the most powerful nation in the world, had a superb army, and of course completely controlled the seas, and they were dealing with the ragtag army of George Washington and a bunch of militia, and they couldn't do it.
General Washington's army had its own problems, too. Congress never had enough money. States often did not do what they were supposed to do. And citizens were not always willing to fight. Soldiers were poorly trained and would promise to serve for only a year or so.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.